BTO Beyond the Obvious, der Ökonomie-Podcast mit Dr. Daniel Stelter. Featured bei Handelsblatt.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe von BTO Refresh. Wir haben es alle gesehen. Die Bilder von Xi, Putin und Modi, die gemeinsam lachen, sich die Hände halten und eine klare Botschaft an die internationale Gemeinschaft schicken. Wir sind die Macht der Zukunft. So zumindest die Idee beim 25. Gipfel der Shanghaier Organisation für Zusammenarbeit. Das Ganze passt gut zum Thema des letzten Sonntags, wo wir diskutiert haben, inwiefern der liberale Westen drauf und dran ist, den Systemwettbewerb zu verlieren. Grund genug für mich, ein Interview, welches ich vor einiger Zeit mit einem indischen Manager geführt habe, für heute nochmal auszuwählen. Er erklärt, welche Rolle Indien für sich selber sieht in der Welt, und wir diskutieren, was das für Deutschland bedeutet. Chancen und Risiken zugleich. Fangen wir also an mit BTO Refresh. In der letzten Woche gab es in China eine eindrucksvolle Demonstration der Macht. Vom 31. August bis 1. September fand in Tianjin der 25. Gipfel der Shanghaier Organisation für Zusammenarbeit statt. Es war die größte Versammlung in der Geschichte der Organisation seit ihrer Gründung im Jahre 2001. Insgesamt kamen über 20 Staatsführer und Vertreter von 10 internationalen Organisationen zusammen und markierten so einen wichtigen Moment in der sich wandelnden geopolitischen Landschaft. Die Veranstaltung wurde vom chinesischen Staatspräsidenten Xi geleitet.
History cautions us that humanity rises and falls together. Only when all countries and nations treat each other as equals, coexist in peace and support each other, can we uphold common security, eradicate the root cause of war, and prevent the reoccurrence of historical tragedies. Comrades and friends, the Chinese nation is the great nation that is never intimidated by any bullies and always values independence and forges ahead. Today, humanity again has to choose between peace and war.
Zu den prominentesten Teilnehmern gehörte neben dem russischen Präsidenten Wladimir Putin zweifellos der indische Premierminister Narendra Modi. Die Mitgliedsländer der Shanghaier Organisation für Zusammenarbeit stehen für immerhin 24% der weltweiten Landmasse, 42% der Weltbevölkerung und rund 23% der weltweiten Wirtschaftsleistung. Sie sind also genau das, was Philip Pilkington am Sonntag hier beschrieb. Sie sind ein Gegengewicht zum liberalen Westen und dieses Gegengewicht wächst und wird zunehmend selbstbewusst.
Really, the rising up of what used to be the poorer part of the world, at least in the post-Enlightenment period, at least in the 19th century period, they're now a larger part of the global economy than the West is, even on broad terms, even if we include Japan and South Korea and these kind of countries in the West, they're growing at a much faster rate. In fact, the Western economies seem to be slipping into stagnation. The fact of the matter, though, is that these other countries are becoming larger and more influential, and everyone can see it.
Zweifellos war die Konferenz in der letzten Woche ein weiterer Schritt in den Bemühungen von China, Russland und anderen, sich als Alternative zur westlich dominierten Weltordnung zu positionieren und zu präsentieren. Xi betonte denn auch in seiner Eröffnungsrede, dass die globale Governance an einem neuen Scheideweg angelangt ist und forderte die Mitgliedstaaten auf, sich, Zitat, fest gegen Hegemonismus und Machtpolitik zu stellen und einen authentischen Multilateralismus zu praktizieren.
We should advocate an equal and orderly multipolar world and a universally beneficial and inclusive economic globalization and make the global governance system more just and equitable. We should strive for real results.
Donald Trump hatte entsprechend reagiert. In seinem sozialen Netzwerk sprach er von einer Gruppe, die sich gegen die USA verbünden würde.
That is the big breaking news that we're getting you at this point in time. In a latest rant, the US President Donald Trump has posted on his Truth Social, says that, and I quote, looks like we've lost India and Russia to deepest, darkest China. May they have a long and prosperous future together, President Donald J. Trump, unquote. The images of Prime Minister Modi clasping Putin's hand and laughing while Xi stood measured but smiling has rubbed the US president the wrong way, it seems.
Die Bilder von Xi, Putin und Modi, wie sie gemeinsam lachen und sich die Hände halten, sind eine klare Botschaft an die internationale Gemeinschaft über die sich verändernden Machtverhältnisse in der Welt. Die Gipfelteilnehmer unterzeichneten eine Erklärung, die eine gestärkte strategische Partnerschaft innerhalb des globalen Südens betont. China kündigte während des Gipfels bedeutende finanzielle Zusagen an, um so die Zusammenarbeit innerhalb der Organisation zu vertiefen. Ein weiteres wichtiges Ergebnis des Gipfels war sicherlich der Beschluss, die Schaffung einer eigenen Entwicklungsbank zu beschleunigen. Diese Initiative stellt einen bedeutenden Schritt dar, zur Verwirklichung des langfristigen Ziels ein alternatives Zahlungssystem zu schaffen und sich so vom US-Dollar unabhängig zu machen. So gesehen spiegelt das Ganze Chinas langfristige politische Strategie wider, Alternativen zur von den USA geführten Weltordnung aufzubauen. Dabei sollten wir natürlich schon nüchtern auf das Ereignis blicken. Die Gruppe ist keineswegs so homogen und geschlossen, wie sie vorgibt zu sein. Die Mitgliedsländer haben durchaus unterschiedliche nationale Prioritäten und Ziele und darüber hinaus gibt es auch jeweils lokale Konflikte. Man denke nur an Pakistan und Indien, aber auch China und Indien sind nicht unbedingt friedliche Nachbarn. Ein besonders bedeutsamer Aspekt des Gipfels war die Annäherung zwischen China und Indien. Modi und Xi trafen sich zum ersten Mal auf chinesischem Boden seit 7 Jahren und verpflichteten sich, ihre Konflikte anzugehen. Die beiden Staatsführer vereinbarten, dass ihre Nationen Entwicklungspartner und nicht Gegner sein sollten und diskutierten Wege zur Verbesserung des bilateralen Handels. Wobei Indien durchaus darauf achtet, einen eigenen Weg zu gehen. Indien ist mit allen im Dialog. Mit China, wie gerade gehört. Mit Russland, bekanntlich ein wichtiger Lieferant von Rüstungsgütern, aber auch Energie. Mit den USA, aber auch mit dem Westen generell. Und dass Deutschland die Bedeutung Indiens durchaus erkannt hat, zeigte der Besuch des Außenministers, der ebenfalls erst kürzlich Indien bereist hat.
Na, ich weiß, dass Indien von jeher eine unabhängige Position eingenommen hat. In Zeiten des Kalten Krieges war Indien Mitglied der sogenannten Blockfreien. Und diese Position hat Indien als selbstbewusstes Land, als größtes Land der Welt, als größte Demokratie deswegen auch automatisch jetzt auch wieder eingenommen. Das ist ein Land, das große Chancen der Zusammenarbeit mit Deutschland bietet. Das habe ich gerade heute hier bei dem Besuch vieler Wirtschaftsunternehmen feststellen können. Diese Möglichkeiten müssen wir nutzen. Deutschland braucht globale Partner und Indien gehört sicherlich zu den privilegierten Partnern, die wir uns suchen müssen.
Das wirtschaftliche Gewicht Indiens hat in den letzten 10 Jahren massiv zugenommen. Und es wird weiter deutlich steigen. Wir haben das ausführlich im Podcast 239 Indien Chance für Deutschland beleuchtet. Damals im Gespräch der indische Manager und Unternehmer Ramabhadran Gopalakrishnan.
haben sie schon mal direkt gehandelt, also so richtig direkt, so dass es gar nicht mehr direkter geht? Nein, dann sollten sie es direkt mal mit der neuen App von Europas direktestem Direktbroker Tradegate Direct ausprobieren. Tradegate Direct wurde von Profis für Profis entwickelt und ist speziell für erfahrene Trader mit hoher Handelsfrequenz gemacht, die Wert auf Kontrolle, Effizienz und Unabhängigkeit legen. Die App ermöglicht Privatanlegern den unmittelbaren Direktzugang zur Tradegate Exchange. Das ist Europas liquideste regulierte Retailbörse. Tradegate Direct ist ein Produkt der Tradegate AG, einem der innovativsten Finanzdienstleister in Europa mit über 30 Jahren Expertise. Die Tradegate AG vereint Market Maker, Börse und Broker. Als Betreiberin der Tradegate Exchange bietet sie direkte Kontrolle über Handelsprozesse, Preisbildung und Orderabwicklung. Das ermöglicht eine transparente, effiziente und marktnahe Orderausführung ohne Umwege aus erster Hand. Sie profitieren von hoher Ausführungsgüte, engen Spreads und minimaler Slippage, was besonders für große Volumen und aktive Strategien entscheidend ist. Zu den App-Features zählen Realtime-Watchlists mit bis zu 150 Titeln, intelligente Ordertypen und Performance-Analysen auf institutionellem Niveau. Mehr als 7000 Aktien, 3000 ETFs und tausende Mini-Futures sind über die App handelbar. Außerdem bleibt der gesamte Handel dauerhaft kostenfrei und das auch bei neuen regulatorischen Vorgaben. Erleben Sie, wie direkter Börsenhandel im Hier und Jetzt funktioniert mit Tradegate Direct. Mehr Informationen in den Shownotes oder unter www.tradegate.direct.
Bevor wir zu meinem Gespräch mit Ramabhadran Gopalakrishnan kommen, noch dieser Hinweis. Hörerinnen und Hörer, die auf die gesamten Inhalte des Handelsblatts zugreifen möchten, um rund um Wirtschaft, Politik und Finanzen auf dem Laufenden zu bleiben, können sich das Handelsblatt jetzt, gedruckt und digital, für 12 Monate mit 30% Rabatt sichern. Das Angebot finden Sie unter dem Link handelsblatt.com/BTO30 und natürlich auch, wie immer, in den Shownotes zu dieser Ausgabe. Doch nun zu meinem Gespräch mit Ramabhadran Gopalakrishnan. Wie immer bei englischsprachigen Interviews kommt nun eine kurze Zusammenfassung der Highlights auf Deutsch und am Ende dann das ganze Interview im Original.
Ramabhadran Gopalakrishnan ist ein indischer Geschäftsmann und Autor. Bis zu seiner Pensionierung war er Geschäftsführer von Tata Sons Limited und Mitglied der Vorstände von Tata Power, Tata Technologies, AkzoNobel India, Castrol India und ABP Private Limited. Bevor er zu Tata kam, war er stellvertretender Vorsitzender von Hindustan Lever, der indischen Tochtergesellschaft von Unilever. Gopalakrishnan hat in Indien, Großbritannien und Saudi-Arabien gelebt und gearbeitet und war Präsident der All India Management Association. Er ist Autor mehrerer Bücher, so unter anderem von The Made in India und Crash, Lessons from the Entry and Exit of CEOs.
Angefangen habe ich mit der Frage, wie denn Gopalakrishnan die Lage in Indien heute einschätzt.
Through good steps and missteps, various governments from Nehru to Modi have built layer upon layer, almost like a semiconductor chips. And what we are seeing today is
durch richtige Schritte und auch Fehltritte haben verschiedene Regierungen von Nehru bis Modi Indien Schicht für Schicht aufgebaut. Das, was wir heute sehen, ist die kumulative Wirkung all dieser Arbeiten. Es gab Fehltritte, daran gibt es keinen Zweifel. Indien ist jetzt in einer sehr guten Position, aber ob Sie es als Abheben bezeichnen wollen, ob Sie der einen oder der anderen Regierung die Ehre geben wollen, ist nicht Gegenstand unserer Diskussion. Ich bin fest davon überzeugt, dass wo Indien heute steht, in der globalen Geopolitik, in der globalen Wirtschaft, in der Globalisierung, ist der kumulative Effekt von 70 Jahren konsequenter Politik. Es gibt also einen sich verstärkenden Effekt. Sie verbessern sich jedes Jahr um 2%, aber plötzlich geht es los. Und wir sind an diesem Wendepunkt.
Consistent policy. So there's a compounding effect, you know, like you do when you do asset management and investment. You improve by 2% every year, but suddenly it takes off. And we are at that inflection point.
Wir sind also an einem Wendepunkt. An einem Wendepunkt, der sicherlich von den aktuellen Veränderungen im geopolitischen Umfeld profitiert. Ich habe ihn dann gefragt, welche Faktoren er denn für entscheidend hält. Bei Bildung und Gesundheit sieht er dies nicht, aber dafür in einem für mich überraschenden Sektor.
So health and education are two areas which were social indicators where India has missed a lot of time. And in the coming years, if we are to become whatever our aspiration is, unless these two are attended, because the human capital has to be invested in. And it's very difficult for the government not to attend to that. Having said that, let me move to the more economic side.
Bei Gesundheit und Bildung hat Indien viel Zeit verstreichen lassen. Und wenn wir in den kommenden Jahren das werden wollen, was wir anstreben, dann muss sich die Regierung darum kümmern. Die große Errungenschaft der Regierungen seit 1947 besteht darin, dass wir, während wir eine arme, von Hungersnöten geplagte Analphabetengesellschaft waren, jetzt in Bezug auf Nahrungsmittel autark sind. Wir sind tatsächlich der weltweit größte Lieferant von Reis und manchmal sogar von Weizen. Das ist also ein großer Durchbruch im Agrarsektor. Wenn sich die Landwirtschaft jedoch sehr schnell entwickelt, hat dies Auswirkungen auf die Umwelt, die Ökologie, die Bodengesundheit und die Grundwasserentnahme. Vor 40 Jahren haben tatsächlich viele Menschen vorausgesagt, dass wir verhungern würden. Wir haben das Gegenteil getan.
And so I cannot say that the farmers are a very happy lot, though they have fed the country. They have issues just like there is in France and Germany and other places where farmers are leading protests and processions. But it is a great tribute to policies and planning in India that whereas we were a sort of a basket case, you know, 40 years ago, and in fact many people predicted that we'll starve ourselves, we have actually done the opposite. So that's a very positive feature, agriculture, but it's work in progress.
In der Tat waren die armen, verhungernden Kinder in Indien ein geflügeltes Wort in meiner Jugend. Und ich denke, dem einen oder anderen Hörer wird es ähnlich ergehen. Doch auch in der Industrie gab es Fortschritte.
We spent the first 30, 40 years controlling industry rather than developing industry. The story is well known.
Wir haben die ersten 30 bis 40 Jahre damit verbracht, die Industrie zu kontrollieren, weil die damaligen Führer sich sehr vom sowjetischen Modell angezogen fühlten. Offen gesagt, viele Intellektuelle fühlen sich immer noch davon angezogen. Aber mittlerweile ist sowohl der Sowjetunion als auch der Außenwelt ziemlich klar, dass das nicht funktioniert. Und als Indien 1991 die Fesseln gelockert hat, unter denen die indische Industrie operiert hat, beschleunigte sich gleichzeitig das industrielle Wachstum.
The shackles under which Indian industry been operating, industrial growth perked up.
Wobei es vor allem die Dienstleistungen sind, wo Gopala Krishnan einen interessanten Vergleich zu China zieht.
Government recognized that there is a great future in services. One of the interesting contrasts between India and China is historically, China has always been a net exporter of things. You know, gunpowder, compass, gadgets, and nowadays soft toys and every plastic item comes from China, all over the world.
Die Regierung hat erkannt, dass Dienstleistungen eine große Zukunft haben. Einer der interessantesten Kontraste zwischen Indien und China besteht darin, dass China historisch gesehen immer ein Nettoexporteur von Dingen war. Sie wissen schon, Schießpulver, Kompass. Heutzutage gibt es Gadgets, Plüschtiere und alle möglichen Plastikartikel kommen aus China. Indien war schon immer ein großer Ideenexporteur. Wissen Sie, der Buddhismus strebt danach zu werden. Philosophie und Musik sind im Grunde unsere Gene und unsere Psyche. Ohne dass wir uns dessen bewusst sind, sind wir stark auf den Export von Dienstleistungen ausgerichtet. Darin sind wir ziemlich gut. Ich nenne das die Soft Power Indiens. Schauen Sie sich Ideen an, die den Westen faszinieren. Yoga. Viele Leute halten Yoga für etwas Amerikanisches, aber es kam aus Indien. Im Einklang mit diesem Gedanken hat Indien auf IT gesetzt. Die IT-Revolution hat einen ganz außergewöhnlichen Anstoß gegeben. Und Indien wurde bekannt. Ich denke, dass dies das Bild der Inder in den letzten 25, 30 Jahren als kluge Ingenieure mit hoher Bildung und hoher Kompetenz geprägt hat. Das war vor 50 Jahren nicht der Fall. Deshalb denke ich, dass wir uns heute natürlich im Übergang befinden. Aber ob es um neue Energien geht oder um künstliche Intelligenz, überall spielt Indien vorne mit.
IT-Revolution, the 90s. And Y2K gave that a very extraordinary fillip. And India became known. I think it's in the last 25, 30 years that the image of Indians outside has been one of clever engineers, highly educated, highly competent. But that wasn't the situation 50 years ago. So today, I think We are in transition, of course, but whether it's in new energy or it is in artificial intelligence, India is at somewhere up in the front. I will hesitate to say it's at the forefront.
Und macht noch einen interessanten Punkt bezüglich der demografischen Entwicklung.
The one thing I must add here, we have done very well, is in population control. You know, this is not celebrated so much in the world, but through entirely peaceful means, without any legislation.
Was ich noch hinzufügen möchte, ist die Bevölkerungskontrolle, die wir sehr gut gemacht haben. Das wird auf der Welt nicht so sehr gefeiert, aber wir haben es mit völlig friedlichen Mitteln ohne jegliche Gesetzgebung erreicht. Es ist uns gelungen, das Bevölkerungswachstum mehr oder weniger auf die Reproduktionsrate zu senken. Ich denke, dass wir von den 1,4 Milliarden immer noch etwas wachsen, aber wir haben es fast geschafft. Tatsächlich sprechen die Leute davon, dass die Bevölkerung wie in anderen Ländern ab 2040 oder 2050 altern wird. In den nächsten 15 bis 20 Jahren werden wir aber noch die jüngste Bevölkerung der Welt haben.
But for the reason that for the next 20 years or at least 15 years we will have the world's youngest population.
Auch dieser Punkt war mir in dieser Deutlichkeit nicht bewusst. Ich habe dann gefragt, ob Indien nicht nun auch davon profitiert, dass es Bemühungen gibt, sich von China unabhängiger zu machen. Nach dem Motto, wir verlagern Produktion nach Indien.
And what you said is quite correct. For example, there's a great thrust right now in the government in India for India to manufacture chips. Obviously, we are not starting at 5 nanometer, 6 nanometer. We are starting at 20 or 30. But the thought is the thinking and the planning is that in 10 years, we could be exporters. So we are talking of scale. Tata themselves are putting up a chip.
Das stimmt. Beispielsweise besteht derzeit großes Vertrauen in der indischen Regierung, dass Indien Chips herstellen kann. Offensichtlich beginnen wir nicht bei 5 Nanometern, 6 Nanometern. Wir fangen mit 20 oder 30 an. Aber das Denken und die Planung ist, dass wir in 10 Jahren Exporteure sein könnten. Ebenso bei Mobiltelefonen. Wir waren immer Importeure aus China, Korea und von sonst wo. Ich glaube, wir exportieren heute Mobiltelefone im Wert von 10 bis 12 Milliarden US-Dollar. Es beginnt vielleicht mit einem geringeren Technologieniveau, aber wir entwickeln uns von dort. Wir geben nicht so viel Geld für Innovation und Wissenschaft aus, wie wir sollten. Ich meine, das war die große Stärke Deutschlands, wenn man auf die Jahrhundertwende zurückblickt.
Backward integration and doing that also very competent. Our weakness, we don't spend as much money as we should on innovation and science. I mean, that was the great strength of Germany, if you go back to the turn of the century. It was a tremendous strength of Germany and chemical companies, armaments companies, metal companies came up. There we are lacking. But then, like every other part of the world, there is no perfect picture. And being conscious of where you have to improve is itself a great step forward. We are not in self-denial on these aspects.
Auch dies klingt nach einer sinnvollen Entwicklung des Landes. Wie sieht denn Indien als Standort für deutsche Unternehmen? Es gibt doch auch negative Aspekte, wie die sprichwörtliche Bürokratie und die langwierigen Gerichtsverfahren. Gopala Krishnan hat mir hier zunächst zugestimmt.
Bureaucracy and judicial redress are both weak points. Or could be better for something that's going to be a $10 trillion economy. We ought to be much better at it. In that sense, we are a bit like the Americans, you know?
Bürokratie und Gerichtsbarkeit sind Schwachstellen oder könnten für eine 10 Billionen Dollar Wirtschaft besser sein. Die USA sind in mancher Hinsicht wirklich ähnlich, aber nur in mancher Hinsicht. Ich möchte nicht den Eindruck erwecken, dass wir uns an den USA orientieren. Wir haben Spaghetti, die müssen wir entwirren. Indische Unternehmer und Geschäftsleute haben Wege gefunden, dies zu tun. Einige durch Vetternwirtschaft, andere durch professionelle Interessenvertretung. Aber man muss es herausfinden. Eine der großen Herausforderungen für ausländische Unternehmen, wenn sie hierher kommen, besteht darin, sich darüber im Klaren zu sein, wie die Sache funktioniert.
But you have to figure it out. And one of the big challenges that foreign companies have when they come here is to try to get their head around how this thing works. And for their life, they can't get it.
Klar ist auf jeden Fall, dass man es mit einem zeitaufwendigen und komplizierten Prozess zu tun hat. Die Lösung liegt darin, auf einheimische Manager zu setzen.
So if I look at companies like Unilever, like Siemens, like the auto companies now, Volkswagen, Mercedes, they're all doing the same thing. You may start with an expatriate, because the cultural value.
Wenn ich mir also Unternehmen wie Unilever und Siemens, die Automobilkonzerne angucke, da machen sie alle das Gleiche. Sie können mit ihren eigenen Leuten beginnen, da die kulturellen Werte der Organisation gewahrt werden, aber sehr bald rekrutieren sie Inder und erlauben Indern, Führungspositionen zu übernehmen. Nestlé ist ein sehr gutes Beispiel. Sie hatten viel Mühe mit ihren Maggi-Nudeln. Schließlich haben sie erkannt, dass ein Schweizer an der Spitze von Nestlé Indien ein Nachteil sein kann. Um das Problem zu lösen, holten sie einen indischen Manager. Und der hatte glänzenden Erfolg.
At the head of Nestlé India, maybe a disadvantage, and to solve the problem, they brought an Indian manager who had been seconded to Malaysia or Egypt or somewhere. And he has been brilliantly successful.
Ich habe Gopalakrishnan dann gefragt, inwiefern die föderale Struktur Indiens die Entwicklung des Landes behindert. Beispiel: Viele Lastwagen dürfen nicht landesweit fahren, was dazu führt, dass Güter an der Grenze umgeladen werden müssen. Also beispielsweise an der Grenze zwischen Thüringen und Bayern, so muss man sich das vorstellen, werden dann Lastwagen umgepackt, weil die Lastwagen eben nicht aus Thüringen nach Bayern hineinfahren dürfen.
Well, technically, as per the legal definition, India is a union of states. And the states are meant to be more or less autonomous.
Ja, technisch gesehen ist Indien gemäß der Definition eine Union von Staaten und diese Staaten sollten es auch sein, bis auf die Verteidigung und vielleicht die Außenpolitik. Wir haben eine Zentralregierung, die alles zentralisieren möchte und das führt natürlich innerhalb Indiens zu Spannungen. Eine der Fähigkeiten, die ein zukünftiger Führer Indiens haben muss, besteht darin, sich an die Veränderungen anzupassen. Das ist ein politisches Problem, dessen Lösung wir den Politikern überlassen müssen.
That's a political problem and we must leave it to the politicians to sort out.
Ein weiteres Thema, was wir besprochen haben, war die Frage nach der Religion. Bekanntlich ist ja das Verhältnis zwischen Moslems und Hindus nicht unbedingt friedlich und hatte ja auch zur Abspaltung Pakistans geführt.
Religion has a role to play also. Like for example, Jammu and Kashmir is a largely Muslim state. So religion has its own overtones. Earlier, there was a lot of accommodation in politics, to say live and let live. It's a bit like the European Union. If you say there's only one way to do it, it's my way, you won't have a European Union.
Religion spielt eine Rolle. Jammu und Kaschmir sind zum Beispiel weitgehend muslimische Staaten. Religion hat also ihre eigenen Untertöne, Leben und Leben lassen. Es ist ein bisschen wie in der Europäischen Union. Wenn Sie sagen, es gibt nur diesen einen Weg, dann gibt es keine Europäische Union. Die gegenwärtige Regierung will alles zentralisieren und verwalten und überall an der Macht sein. Das bringt eigene politische Nebenwirkungen mit sich, mit denen sich Politiker auseinandersetzen müssen. Es ist sicher nicht einfach, Indien als Einheit zu regieren. Und ich fürchte, jeder, der denkt, dass er Indien ohne Beschwichtigung und ohne Entgegenkommen regieren kann, irrt sich. Die aktuelle Regierung tendiert zum Image eines starken Mannes. Wie weit sie damit kommt, werden wir sehen. Wenn man ein Land regiert, ist Beschwichtigung und Anpassung eine Tugend. Die derzeitige Regierung glaubt nicht daran. Hier kommt der muslimische Blickwinkel ins Spiel. Tatsache ist, dass es 200 Millionen Muslime gibt. Sie könnten vor 500, vor 1000 oder vor 2000 Jahren zugewandert sein. Und ich denke, das wird sich auswirken, wenn diese Regierung die nächste Amtszeit anstrebt.
But when you're running a country, appeasement and accommodation is a virtue. And the present government does not think so. At least they don't say so. And they are quite intolerant of appeasement. And that's where the Muslim angle comes in. The fact is that you have 200 million Muslims. They might have migrated 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. And I think that's something that will play out as this government seeks the next term and tries to get a third term.
Spielt denn heutzutage in Indien das Kastenwesen immer noch eine Rolle? In diesem Bereich sieht Gopalakrishnan zurzeit eine schlechte Wirkung der Politik, da diese den Kastengedanken wieder mehr betont, um daraus einen politischen Vorteil zu ziehen.
See, the caste system is so ingrained that its importance is diminishing, but it's still very much there.
Das Kastensystem ist tief verwurzelt. Die Bedeutung nimmt ab, aber es ist immer noch vorhanden. Man sollte nicht so tun, als ob es das nicht gäbe. Das Kastensystem kann man nicht durch Gesetze ändern, sondern man muss es wie bei der Familienplanung machen. Es hat 50 Jahre gedauert, bis die Bevölkerung stabilisiert war und es eine konsistente Botschaft gibt. Wissen Sie, die Politik läuft umgekehrt ab. Sie betonen die Kaste, Menschen jener Kaste, Menschen dieser Kaste. Wenn etwas in der politischen Atmosphäre im Überfluss vorhanden ist und man erwartet, dass es von der sozialen Seite verschwindet, ist das ein bisschen albern. Nehmen Sie die Familienplanung als Lektion. Es funktioniert über Kommunikation. Aber wir machen im Moment das Gegenteil.
Take a lesson from our family planning exercise, which is communication for over 50, 60 years. But we are doing the opposite at the point of time.
Trotz aller Fortschritte gibt es allerdings auch nicht so gute Entwicklungen. So nimmt, wie bereits angesprochen, die Ungleichheit deutlich zu. Auf der einen Seite also Armut und auf der anderen Seite das teuerste Wohngebäude der Welt für $1 Milliarde in Mumbai. Ich selbst habe dieses Gebäude übrigens vor über 10 Jahren mal besucht und ich muss zugeben, ich war durchaus beeindruckt. Gopala Krishnan sieht das durchaus kritisch.
There is a problem, because when you have exceedingly wealthy people up at the top 0.5% or 1%, then you are very prone to crony capitalism in the politics.
Das ist ein Problem, wenn man überaus wohlhabende Leute hat, dann ist man sehr anfällig für Vetternwirtschaft. In der Politik verschafft man sich dann einen unfairen Vorteil, weil man über Geldmacht verfügt. Politiker lieben Geld überall auf der Welt. Obwohl es Vor- und Nachteile gibt, wird die Kluft insgesamt immer größer. Sehr wichtig. Es kommt nicht auf die tatsächliche Lücke an, sondern auf die Wahrnehmung der Lücke.
It is not the actual gap that matters, but the perception of the gap. The perception of the gap is more important.
Denn wir dürfen nicht vergessen, dass die absolute Armut trotz aller erzielten Fortschritte noch immer sehr hoch ist.
If you're able to lift the very, very poor, one of the great achievements of the previous government, before the current one, was that they lifted.
Eine der großen Errungenschaften der früheren Regierung ist, etwa 200 bis 250 Millionen Menschen aus der Armut herausgeholt zu haben, die Ökonomen als extreme Armut bezeichnen. Dann kam natürlich Covid und es macht es wieder schlimmer. Tatsache ist, dass in einem Land, in dem sie 800 Millionen Menschen mit kostenlosem Getreide versorgen, ein Land ist, vor dem man nicht sagen kann, dass es keine Armut mehr gibt. 800 Millionen, das ist das weltweit größte Nahrungsmittelprogramm.
To 800 million people, you can't say that poverty is behind you. 800 million is the world's largest food program.
Natürlich muss sich Gopala Krishnan fragen, wie denn Indien angesichts der enormen Herausforderungen, gerade bei der Entwicklung von Gesellschaft und auch sozialem Ausgleich, zu dem Thema Klimaschutz steht, der bekanntlich bei uns die Agenda dominiert.
That we got so many people who are waiting in the escalator to get a chance to come up. If we have to make more coal-based power, we will do so. But at the upper end, let us try to convert as much as we can into renewables. We are already at 300 or 500 gigawatts of solar power.
Viele Leute hoffen darauf, dass es ihnen besser gehen wird. Wenn wir mehr Kohlestrom erzeugen müssen, werden wir das tun. Aber am oberen Ende sollten wir versuchen, so viel wie möglich aus erneuerbaren Energien zu gewinnen. Wir sind bereits bei 300 bis 500 Gigawatt Solarstrom. Wir haben viel mit Windkraft gemacht, aber sobald man die Windmühle aufstellt, hört der Wind auf zu wehen. Das ist also ein Problem. Aber es wird viel an Elektrofahrzeugen, Batterien und erneuerbaren Energien gearbeitet. Die öffentliche Erzählung, die Sie hören, ist also, dass der Premierminister oder ein hochrangiger Beamter die Notwendigkeit von Maßnahmen gegen den Klimawandel betont. Sie werden auch hören, dass Indien mehr Kohle fördern muss. Ich erinnere mich, dass ich John Kerry einmal in Boston getroffen habe. Er hat gesagt, ich werde übermorgen einen Flug nehmen, um Ihrem Premierminister mitzuteilen, dass er ein Verbot der Stromerzeugung aus Kohle erlassen sollte. Ich sagte, Herr Senator, Sie können gerne nach Indien gehen und jedem sagen, was Sie wollen. Aber Indien wird das tun, was den Indern gut tut. Und es ist nicht praktikabel zu sagen, keine Kohle mehr verbrennen. Wenn Sie also Al Gore, John Kerry oder Ihre eigene grüne Partei in Deutschland sind, dann neigen Sie dazu, die Welt wie Greta Thunberg nur auf eine Weise zu sehen. Der Umgang mit Widersprüchen ist ein wesentlicher Bestandteil der in Indien geforderten Führungskompetenzen. Der Umgang mit den Widersprüchen der Energie ist die Führungskompetenz, die jeder auf der ganzen Welt benötigt.
In Germany, then you tend to see the world Greta Thunberg type, you know, in only one way. But like managing contradictions is an essential part of the leadership skills required in India, managing the contradictions of energy is a leadership skill required by everybody, everywhere in the world.
Das war nicht der einzige Moment, wo ich im Rahmen des Gespräches an den Irrsinn der hiesigen Energiepolitik denken musste. Doch kommen wir zurück zu Indien. Ich habe Gopalakrishnan dann gefragt, wo denn Indien geopolitisch steht. Man kauft Öl und Waffen aus Russland, man hat einen Grenzkonflikt mit China und zugleich ist man dem Westen verbunden, aber dann doch wiederum nicht bei allen Themen gleicher Meinung.
But India in itself has charted its course and means to be an important player at the table, on par with other people. So that's the way you'll find India's body language and foreign policy working. We've never been in anybody's camp.
Indien will ein wichtiger Akteur am Tisch sein, auf Augenhöhe mit anderen Nationen. Wir waren noch nie im Lager von irgendjemandem. Ich meine, nehmen Sie die Situation in Gaza, Israel, nehmen Sie die Ukraine und die Position des Rests der Welt oder aus europäischer oder britischer Sicht oder aus amerikanischer Sicht. Sie denken möglicherweise, dass Indien sich gegen alle absichert. Das könnte Ihr Eindruck sein. Aber Indien sagt, dass Russland einen Punkt hat, so wie der Westen einen Punkt hat. Wir sagen, kann man nicht miteinander reden, weil die Probleme der Welt dadurch gelöst würden, dass man miteinander redet? In gleicher Weise funktioniert Indiens Außenpolitik. Wir werden am Tisch Platz nehmen und mit den USA oder Europa auf Augenhöhe sprechen. Das ist die Haltung. Und deshalb finden es manche Menschen etwas komplex, die Position Indiens zu verstehen.
So in the same way, India's foreign policy is working and the way India thinks about it, we will have a seat at the table. And we'll sit and talk with the US or Europe on far more equal terms than in the past, because the scale is tipping. That is the essence. And that's why some people find it a bit complex to understand India's position.
Wenn nun deutsche Unternehmen nach Indien gehen wollen, wie schätzt Gopalakrishnan die Chancen ein und worauf müssen die Unternehmen achten?
You know, Germany has been a intellectual and scientific leader for a long time. And an economic leader, of course. But my
Deutschland ist seit langem intellektuell und wissenschaftlich führend und natürlich auch wirtschaftlich. Mein Vorschlag oder Tipp wäre zu erkennen, dass man sich auf dem Höhepunkt befindet oder den Höhepunkt überschritten hat. Wenn Sie weiterhin erfolgreich sein und wachsen wollen, dann geschieht dies nicht durch Konkurrenz, sondern durch Zusammenarbeit. Mir ist nicht bekannt, dass Deutschland in der grenzüberschreitenden Zusammenarbeit eine besonders starke Bilanz vorzuweisen hat. Der große Tipp, den ich geben würde, ist also, gehen Sie raus und versuchen Sie, die reale Welt zu verstehen, insbesondere Ihr Mittelstand. Der ist die große Stärke Deutschlands. Ich spreche nicht von Siemens oder von Volkswagen. Heute findet man in Indien jedes deutsche Unternehmen in einer Premium-Variante. Es gibt 50 bis 100 Millionen Menschen, denen ich meinen Porsche verkaufen kann. Wir haben einen sehr lebendigen Mittelstand in Indien und Sie haben einen sehr lebendigen Mittelstand in Deutschland. Das ist die Verbindung der Bäuche, nicht der Köpfe. Das wäre der Tipp, den ich geben kann.
We have a very vibrant Mittelstand in India and you have a very vibrant Mittelstand in Germany. That's the join at the bellies, not at the heads. That would be the tip that I would give.
Und wie sieht es aus mit den Bemühungen, Fachkräfte aus Indien nach Deutschland zu locken? Wäre es nicht besser, diese Fachkräfte würden in Indien bleiben und mithelfen, Indien zu entwickeln?
I think if Germany can attract people, it should. It used to do that with the Hochschule program, you know?
Ich denke, wenn Deutschland Menschen anziehen kann, dann sollte es das auch tun. Das war früher so, als ich dorthin ging, um Deutsch zu lernen, weil es in den 60er Jahren eine attraktive Möglichkeit war, wobei die Sprache eine offensichtliche Barriere sein kann. Indien ist ein sehr gutes Land in Sprachen. Die meisten Inder sprechen 3 oder 4 Sprachen. Ein Bauer aus Punjab kann nach Italien gehen und Weintrauben für die Italiener anbauen oder nach Kanada gehen und Weizen für die Kanadier anbauen. Welche Menschen will Deutschland, wenn sie intelligente Menschen brauchen, und das ist meiner Meinung nach die Frage, dann wäre ein sehr aktives Programm zur Gewinnung indischer Studenten heute sicherlich sehr willkommen. Jeder möchte seine Kinder nach Amerika oder England schicken. Ich denke immer noch, dass Deutschland ein gutes Bildungssystem hat, vor allem in der Berufsausbildung. Deutschland ist sehr gut in der Kompetenzentwicklung, was Indien einfach fehlt. Auch hier kommt es wieder auf den Mittelstand an.
Today, anybody wants to send his children to America or England. I still think Germany has a good educational system. And especially in skill development. Germany is very good at skill development, which India sorely lacks. Again, it comes back to the Mittelstand.
Am Sonntag haben wir gesehen, wie stark die westliche Welt herausgefordert wird durch China, Russland, Indien und andere. Zugleich haben wir gesehen, wie sehr der Westen sich selbst geschwächt hat, um in diesem Systemwettbewerb zu bestehen. Eine Antwort darauf lautet, natürlich selbst an eigenen Schwächen zu arbeiten. Die andere Antwort lautet, sich die richtigen Alliierten zu suchen. Und ein wichtiger Verbündeter in der zukünftigen Welt ist zweifellos Indien. Gut also, dass Indien im Fokus der deutschen Politik ist und gut also, dass Unternehmen die Chancen nutzen, die Indien bietet. Wie groß diese sind, das, denke ich, wurde im Gespräch mehr als deutlich. Soweit BTO Refresh für heute. Am kommenden Sonntag geht es wie gewohnt weiter mit einem neuen Gespräch. Ich freue mich auf Fragen, Kritik und Anregungen. Und natürlich etwas wiederhören am kommenden Sonntag. Bis dann alles Gute, Ihr Daniel Stelter. Und jetzt das Gespräch in voller Länge. Dear Mr. Gopalakrishnan, it's a great pleasure to welcome you to my podcast.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure to be with you.
I would like to talk with you about India. Of course, even we in Germany, we have learned that India is developing, that India is growing, that India is the big beneficiary of probably the issues we have with China. But probably we start with your view around, you know, having seen the Indian business and Indian economy for decades. So what's your view on the state of India today?
You know, my view is that India is progressing. Not perfectly, but quite well. And I want to emphasize that politicians will take the credit for it. But that's not the subject of our discussion. Very systematically, after the ravages of partition, 1947, through good steps and missteps, various governments, from Nehru to Modi, have built layer upon layer, almost like a semiconductor chips. And what we are seeing today is the cumulative effect of all the work, which on the whole has been more positive than negative. There have been missteps, no doubt about it. And so India is at a very good position now, whether you want to call it takeoff, whether you want to give the credit to one government or another, is not the subject of our discussion. But it is my firm belief that where India is standing today in global geopolitics, in global economics, in globalization, is the cumulative effect of 70 years of consistent policy. So there's a compounding effect, you know, like you do when you do asset management and investment. You improve by 2% every year, but suddenly it takes off. And we are at that inflection point. And of course, success has many fathers. And so there'll be many people to claim the credit for it.
So I understand that many people take credit for it and we don't want to talk politics, but why don't we talk about the factors? What has been, in your view, what has been the factor of the 2%? Is it because, you know, on the one hand, you have a huge population growth still, you know, other countries like China are now shrinking, India is still growing, you've got 1.4 billion people. So is it just demographics? Or are there other factors? For example, education. I think education system is very important. Then there we have mixed stories. You know, on the one hand, we all know the very smart Indians who come to the US or to Europe to study and to found companies. On the other hand, we hear the stories about teachers who don't teach because they are not well enough paid by the government. So if you could dive in into the factors behind these 2%.
Let me say this, that two sectors that India has not done as well as I would have liked as a citizen of India is education and health, public health. What happened over the last several decades is that, rightly or wrongly, government made a greater focus on higher education, subsidized it, So we set up all these IITs, IIMs, which you might have heard of. But primary schools and secondary schools, which largely stayed in the public sector, in the government sector, have lagged woefully for the size of this country. On the flip side, on health, barring one or two states like Kerala and Tamil Nadu, where due to a number of reasons, public health infrastructure is not bad, it is quite woeful in other places. So health and education are two areas which were social indicators where India has missed a lot of time. And in the coming years, if we are to become whatever our aspiration is, unless these two are attended, because the human capital has to be invested in. And it's very difficult for the government not to attend to that. Having said that, let me move to the more economic side. The big achievement of this government, of these governments since 1947, has been that whereas we were a poor, famine-stricken, illiterate society, we are now self-sufficient in food grains. We are actually the world's largest supplier of rice and sometimes even wheat. So that's a big breakthrough in the agriculture sector. But when you have very rapid development in agriculture, there are consequential effects like environment, like ecology, like soil health, like the drawing of groundwater. And we have work to do there. And so I cannot say that the farmers are a very happy lot. Though they have fed the country, they have issues just like there is in France and Germany and other places where farmers are leading protests and processions. But it is a great tribute to policies and planning in India that whereas we were a sort of a basket case, you know, 40 years ago, and in fact many people predicted that we'll starve ourselves, we have actually done the opposite. So that's a very positive feature, agriculture, but it's work in progress. It's not something that's done. On industry, we spent the first 30, 40 years controlling industry rather than developing industry. The story is well known, and I don't think I would, unless you have a question, I will not repeat it. Because the leaders at that time were very attracted to the Soviet model, which frankly many intellectuals were attracted to in those days. But it's now fairly clear, both to the Soviet Union and outside, that that doesn't work. And therefore, in 1991, when India loosened the shackles under which Indian industry had been operating, industrial growth perked up. Simultaneously, government recognized that there is a great future in services. One of the interesting contrasts between India and China is historically, China has always been a net exporter of things. You know, gunpowder, compass, gadgets, and nowadays soft toys and every plastic item comes from China, all over the world. India has always been a great exporter of ideas. You know, Buddhism, Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means all mankind is one humanity. Philosophy, music, art. Fundamentally, our genes and our psyche in India, without our being conscious of it, is very much geared to exporting services. We are quite good at that. I call that the soft power of India compared to China, which is in hard power, you know, goods. So you look at ideas that are captivating the West, yoga, and many people think yoga is an American thing, you know, but it went from India. So I think in line with that thinking, India got the IT wave and found it could be, despite all the difficulties of its infrastructure, it could be a potential force to be initially the back office to the world. And I think that story has been well told, the IT revolution, the 90s. And Y2K gave that a very extraordinary fillip, and India became known. I think it's in the last 25, 30 years that the image of Indians outside has been one of clever engineers, highly educated, highly competent. But that wasn't the situation 50 years ago. So today, I think we are in transition, of course, but whether it's in new energy or it is in artificial intelligence, India is at somewhere up in the front. I will hesitate to say it's at the forefront. And the evidence for this is that many international companies have set up what they call global service centers in India. 3 weeks ago, I visited Volkswagen. There are several companies that have set up global service centers, which are their own employees working for their parent company in Germany or UK or wherever. They're employing the top-class engineers. And I think it's the global service centers are one of the fastest growing part of employing the high-quality people and skilled engineers. So if I have to summarize what I've said, could have done better in education and public health, because that's what concerns the common man. But on the economic growth side, we have done quite well in agriculture, but we need to correct a lot of things. We have done reasonably well in industrial manufactures, not as good as the Mittelstand in Germany, but that will be our aspiration. But we have done quite well in knowledge services. The one thing I must add here, we have done very well, is in population control. You know, this is not celebrated so much in the world, but through entirely peaceful means, without any legislation, we have managed to bring down our population growth rate to the replacement rate, more or less. I think at 1.4 billion, we are still growing, but we are almost there. In another 10, 15, 20 years, I'm not sure when, we would have reached steady state. In fact, people are talking of becoming an aging population, as in other countries, by 2040 or 50. Well, I won't be around by then, but this is a natural phenomenon that's happening in many societies, and I think it will happen in India also. But for the reason that for the next 20 years, or at least 15 years, we will have the world's youngest population. We will have a lot of inequality, but our population will stabilize. And if the economic growth continues the way it is, I see a very positive environment for India, which the world has taken notice of already.
You made a very good description of the development of India. I got one question concerning manufacturing versus services, because I understand what you said, giving the historic development, but currently, I think India is very much trying to lure away manufacturing from China into India. So isn't there now a manufacturing wave coming with Apple and other companies moving production to China, to India, sorry?
When I was talking about India being good at services, I wasn't suggesting that it is to suppress manufacturing. Manufacturing is a bus that I think we missed, or at least we were late to catch that bus. And what you said is quite correct. For example, there's a great thrust right now in the government in India for India to manufacture chips. Obviously, we are not starting at 5 nanometer, 6 nanometer. We are starting at 20 or 30. But the thought is the thinking and the planning, is that in 10 years, we could be exporters. So we are talking of scale. Tata themselves are putting up a chip plant and manufacturing is coming. Likewise with cell phones. We were importers of all sorts of funny cell phones. Funny meaning clunky ones coming from China, Korea, wherever. I think today we export $10 to $12 billion worth of cell phones. To start with, it may be screwdriver technology and assembly, but you have to start somewhere. But one of the good things that India has had experience of is it might start with a lighter level of technology, but has proved reasonably competent, not as competent as I would like as an Indian citizen, and backward integration, and doing that also very competent. Our weakness, we don't spend as much money as we should on innovation and science. I mean, that was a great strength of Germany. If you go back to the turn of the century, it was a tremendous strength of Germany, and chemical companies, armaments companies, metal companies came up. There we are lacking. But then, like every other part of the world, there is no perfect picture. And being conscious of where you have to improve is itself a great step forward. We are not in self-denial on these aspects.
Now, the Indian government or the Indian society is infamous, I would say, for bureaucracy or for the judicial processes. So if you have to go to court in India, the understanding is it can take decades until you get a ruling. Is this still true, or do you see also some improvements there?
It is still true. Unfortunately, our bureaucracy and judicial system is tied up in such a complicated knot that to open it when a ruling party is looking at their next election 5 years from now, it doesn't get its attention. Governments try to do something about it. I'm not saying nobody is bothered about it, including the present one. But if you say, what's your weak point? I would say our bureaucracy and judicial redress are both weak points, or could be better for something that's going to be a $10 trillion economy. We ought to be much better at it. In that sense, we are a bit like the Americans, you know, because there's state, there's federal government, there are laws here, there are courts here, and we can go around in circles quite a lot. And the US is really in some ways similar, but only in some ways. I don't want to give the impression that we are modeled on the US. We have a spaghetti which we have to unravel to move forward. And Indian entrepreneurs and businessmen have figured it out. Some through crony capitalism, some through professional advocacy. But you have to figure it out. And one of the big challenges that foreign companies have when they come here is to try to get their head around how this thing works. And for their life, they can't get it.
Which is, of course, not very positive if you want to attract foreign investment.
True. That's why many people who come from abroad have been people and who are successful in India, have been here either as joint ventures or as listed companies or as private companies for 30, 40, 50 years and have built up that internal knowledge by recruiting Indian managers. So if I look at companies like Unilever, like Siemens, like the auto companies now, Volkswagen, Mercedes, they're all doing the same thing. You may start with an expatriate because the cultural values of the organization have to be set. But very soon they recruit Indians and they allow Indians to take charge of senior positions and guide them. Nestle is a very good example. It's not a German company, but it's a Swiss company. They got into a lot of trouble with their Maggi noodles. And the more they poked their fork into the noodles, the more complicated it got. Finally, they realized that having a Swiss person at the head of Nestle India may be a disadvantage. And to solve the problem, they brought an Indian manager who had been seconded to Malaysia or Egypt or somewhere. And he has been brilliantly successful. So he has been inducted and trained in the Nestle way of thinking. He has worked abroad in Nestle. But once he's back in India, he understands the Indian way of working. And here, now Maggi is still the number one brand in noodles. It looked like one day they'd be finished. So we need a very interesting combination of an international outlook with a patience to deal with the Indian system, which comes out of years of experience.
I would like to dive a little bit into the Indian system. And again, please excuse me for my outside view. One view is I learned, for example, that the states, the separate states of India, they are really very separate. So, for example, I learned that trucks cannot drive everywhere. You cannot have a truck driving from Delhi to Calcutta because some trucks might not be allowed to cross the border between states. So there are trucks driving to the border between states within India, unloading their load and reloading another truck to keep on driving. So just one example. So is India really one country or is it just a union of separate states? Because for foreigners, it's a strange story that trucks have to get into the borders. It's like, you know, if you go from Berlin to Bavaria, you have to cross several borders as each time to unload and reload would be a bit crazy.
Well, technically, as per the legal definition, India is a union of states. And it is true that until about, I would say, 10, 15 years ago, what you said used to happen. Trucks would have to stop at the border, load, unload. Our logistics were very inefficient. But it's changed quite dramatically now through a goods and service tax, which is for the whole country. And with the digitization of that process, for example, I'm told, I'm a bit removed from the operational detail, that a truck which could take 2 weeks to go from Bombay to Calcutta can now do it in 6 days. So, in economic terms, to make India one is work very much at an advanced stage. Where probably we are struggling is to make it politically one. Because we are a union of states and the states are meant to be more or less autonomous, except for defense, foreign exchange, foreign policy. Increasingly, in the last 10 years, we have a central government which is centralizing everything. And that's causing a tension between the state and the center. And you must be reading about it in the newspapers. But that's political. One of the skills required by the future leader of India is to recreate the skill of adjusting and accommodating to move ahead. That was a marked feature earlier of governments where they would accommodate. And so everything was not logical, but they had to keep the thing moving. It's like in a marriage, you know, or in a family. You have to accommodate multiple points of view. Although if you say your view is the only view that's right, then it leads to a breakdown. And one of the serious issues that the current government has to address, I hope they realize it, they can't get along with any state government which is in opposition. That's a political problem and we must leave it to the politicians to sort out.
But is it only a political problem or is it also a problem of religion, if I may ask? Because I think there was a separation from Pakistan, and which still causes some headache for many Indians who think it was a mistake. And still, I heard, I don't know if it's true, that now there are more Muslim people living in India than in Pakistan. So is it also long sides of religion or is it not an issue?
One is the jurisdiction of the state and the center, which is what I've alluded to a few minutes ago. But the confrontation between center and state is by political party and not by religion. But religion has a role to play also. Like, for example, Jammu and Kashmir is a largely Muslim state. So religion has its own overtones. Earlier, there was a lot of accommodation in politics to say live and let live. It's a bit like the European Union. If you say there's only one way to do it, it's my way, you won't have a European Union. So there's lots of accommodation. You go around in circles a bit. But the present government is showing signs that they want to centralize and run everything and they want to be the party in power everywhere. That comes with its own political side effects, which the politicians will deal with. Not easy to run India as one, that's for sure, politically. And anybody who thinks that he can run India without appeasement and accommodation, I have a fear will be mistaken. And the current government has that tendency of the strongman image. How far they take it, we'll have to see. But the one thing that will not work in India, because we are a very heterogeneous country, as you know, by religion, by age group, by language, you name it. And it's like a big family, where there's a patriarch, there are four brothers, four sisters, their spouses, their children. To carry everybody with you is not at all easy. And if you look at some of the most wealthy business families in Europe, in France or Germany, they have their own fights in between, or Italy for that matter. You know, recently Ira von Fürstenberg passed away from the Agnelli family. They all come out of the inability to accommodate in leading their own lives. That's their call, not mine or yours. But when you're running a country, appeasement and accommodation is a virtue. And the present government does not think so. At least they don't say so. And they are quite intolerant of appeasement. And that's where the Muslim angle comes in. The fact is that you have 200 million Muslims. You can't wish it away. You should not exterminate them. Even the thought should not come to your mind. They are no less Indian than me or anybody else. They don't know when their families came to India. They might have migrated 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. And I think that's something that will play out as this government seeks the next term and tries to get a third term. The danger that if I was called by the PM and said, do you have any advice for me? He doesn't call me, so I don't tell him. But in a benign sense, not in a political sense, the advice I would give is, Mr. Prime Minister, you're in danger right now of becoming a megalomaniac. Be careful. It's exactly what I would have told Napoleon if I was alive then, or Adolf Hitler, if they had called me at the right time. But it's a dramatic way of saying that power goes to people's heads, in companies, in countries, in societies. Why should India or the Bharatiya Janata Party or anybody be different? And when you're treated as though you're the reincarnation of Alexander the Great or Napoleon Bonaparte, then you're in a danger zone. It's like what you can tell a CEO, you know, if you have the relationship with him to tell it. But anyway, Mr. Modi is not asking me, so I'm not telling you.
Aha. As you didn't manage the caste system, and I was curious because when I was traveling, India, I had a guide at one stage last autumn, and we asked him about, he has got two sons, and we asked him, can your sons marry who they want? And he says, yeah, yes, they're totally free. We don't arrange unless they ask us. The only precondition is the person they want to marry has to be from this caste, because we're in this caste. So the caste system is still quite important in India or not?
See, the caste system is so ingrained that its importance is diminishing, but it's still very much there. And to pretend that it doesn't exist, you know, it's like when I go to Europe, from the name sometimes you can guess that person is Jewish. And there is a undercurrent which comes out in a conversation if you know the person well. And it's that sort of thing that happens in caste. If I take my own case, none of my three children has married in the same caste. None of them has married from the same group. They are bound to be happy, and all I did was, as a parent, just make sure you don't go and do the wrong thing, you know. After that, you manage your own affairs. There's nothing else a parent can do. The caste system is not something that can be wished away through legislation. But like it happened with family planning, it's taken 50 years to stabilize the population. If there's a consistent messaging on the need to eliminate caste in our thinking, in 50 years, it could be substantially diminished. It won't happen in 5 years. In our politics, it's happening the other way around. They're emphasizing the caste. People of this caste people of that caste, people are caste-based parties. So when something is abounding in the political atmosphere, to expect it to vanish from the social side is a bit silly. I mean, if you go back 100 years, in Europe, there were definitely countries where if a Catholic married a Protestant, it would be frowned upon, right? It may not be so today, but even today in a very conservative family, it happened. I do think caste is something that is a brake on the automobile. And the only way to deal with caste, take a lesson from our family planning exercise, which is communication for over 50, 60 years. But we are doing the opposite at the point of time.
So still India is on a track to improve the wealth of the citizens. I think from the 1.4 billion Indians today, still 1 billion is very poor. 300 million are in the range of probably, you know, lower income, and just 100 million are already living on a Western European standard. So is the economic process going hand in hand with reducing poverty in India?
No, I regret to point out that our economic policy is going in the opposite direction. It's increasing inequality.
You implemented this payment system via the mobile phone, and you know, which is very efficient and everyone can pay with. And the mobile phone penetration is very high. So even, you know, we visited a slum, and you know, in contrast to what European people might think about the slum looked very well organized. Of course, it was dirty, but it was dense, but it was people working. There were not so many people begging. It was people were working, they're producing some stuff, collecting stuff, you know, tailors or collecting plastic and reusing it. So isn't this already helping also the poor parts of society that they get access to, you know, these payment systems, et cetera, et cetera? So isn't this a kind of progress?
You're quite right. The trouble in India is you're never sure whether you've encountered the really poor people. You know, there are poorer people than what you might have seen in the slum. And there are poorer people than the ones I might have seen in the village. So there's always somebody else on the escalator. It's not that the escalator is this long and you can see. And the problem is not that we are not improving the lives of the poorer people for the reasons that you mentioned. I think the real problem is that the rich are getting richer. Now, this is a Republican-Democrat kind of debate in the United States.
On the other hand, the most expensive private home in Mumbai, which is a skyscraper, and if you got a wedding, I don't know, what was it, $100 million or whatever, the wedding and people flying in. On the other hand, you can say, well, you know, but it's a successful company and they create jobs. And I also heard that, you know, many of the rich Indians are investing money in education and supporting society. So is it truly a problem or is it just, you know, the wrong signaling?
No, it's a bit of both. There is a problem because when you have exceedingly wealthy people, up at the top 0.5% or 1%, then you're very prone to crony capitalism in the politics. Then you get unfair advantage because you have money power. I won't go into the examples because right now we are playing out. Politicians love money anywhere in the world. While there are pluses and minuses, on the whole, the gap is widening. Very important. It is not the actual gap that matters, but the perception of the gap. The perception of the gap is more important. So if I host a dinner party in my house, which I can perfectly well afford, and call 40 people and serve some nice French wine, I cannot prevent the staff in my house thinking to themselves, my God, he's called 20 foreigners. He served them things that I know are very expensive. He's had so many people serving the liquor and the food because we all have servants here. And this is going to take me 2 years' salary or 3 years' salary. He will think that because his minimum is not being met. So we have pluses and minuses. You have pointed out some of the pluses. I'm pointing out some of the minuses. Both are true. But on the whole, if you're able to lift the very, very poor, one of the great achievements of the previous government, before the current one, was that they lifted about 200, 250 million people out of what the economists call extreme poverty. I think it's $10 or $1 or something. Then, of course, COVID came and pushed them back. Economists and statisticians can play around with numbers. So the present government is trying to prove that all of them have been pulled back. But then there are equally strong views to the contrary. So I don't want to get into that angle. The fact of the matter is that in a country where you're supplying free food grades to 800 million people, you can't say that poverty is behind you. 800 million is the world's largest food program. I mean, it's mind-boggling. But that's what's happening here. So there must be, common sense tells you, there must be an extreme sense of lack of carbohydrates, nutrition, and food, because you want to deliver to 800 million people. Whether it's good or bad, fiscally, that's a separate subject. It shows you how much is the perception of the gap. The government announces with great pride, and I think some legitimate pride, that we are serving and feeding 800 million people. But the flip side is, then, where is the progress of India happening? In the top 2%? Because 800 million out of 1.4 is 60%. So both are true. And that's one of the remarkable things about any society, but certainly in India. For any statement you make, the opposite is also true. And therefore, I have found it very valuable during my career to go out and see and judge for yourself. You may still get it wrong, but don't rely on economist statistics. Not because economists are bad, but, you know, they can do as well as the data set that they have. And they are prisoners of that data set.
You know, with India growing so fast down the road and becoming the second biggest or the third economy of the world, of course, from a European perspective, German perspective, the question will always come up concerning the climate impact. I don't know, is climate change a topic for India at all, given the poverty and other priorities? And if it is, how is it going to affect politics or economic priorities?
You know, that's a very good question you asked. And the approach that India has taken is, we will do what's in our self-interest, like we've done with our foreign policy. What does that mean? That we've got so many people who are waiting in the escalator to get a chance to come up. If we have to make more coal-based power, we will do so. But at the upper end, let us try to convert as much as we can into renewables. So I think we are already at 300 or 500 gigawatts of solar power. Hydroelectric power has a limitation because it has other implications. We did a lot with wind power, but then the wind stops blowing as soon as you put up that windmill, so that's a problem. But a lot of work is going on EVs and batteries and renewable energy. So the public narrative that you will hear and see is, Prime Minister or some senior officer emphasizes need for climate change measures by India. You'll also see another item saying that India to mine more coal. The purists of climate change see red when they see the second part. How can you mine coal? I remember I met John Kerry once in Boston when I was in service. He said, I'm catching a flight day after tomorrow to go and tell your Prime Minister, put a ban on coal-fired electricity generation. I said, Mr. Senator, you're welcome to go to India and tell whoever what you want, but India will do what's good for Indians. And it is not practical to say, don't put up any more coal-fired. But good luck to you, Mr. Kerry. So if you're an Al Gore or a John Kerry, you tend to see all your own Green Party in Germany, then you tend to see the world Greta Thunberg type, you know, in only one way. But like managing contradictions is an essential part of the leadership skills required in India, managing the contradictions of energy is a leadership skill required by everybody, everywhere in the world. You see the hydrocarbon companies Mr. Exxon or Mr. Shell will get up and say something which may upset a lot of people. But the fact of the matter is you can't just switch off. And we have to manage this transition. And the nations of the world are not very good at talking to each other and providing the money for it. I think the approach India is taking is to do its own thing as far as it can. So we'll find a lot of emphasis here on renewable power. You'll also find some emphasis on mining coal and putting up coal-based plants. You'll find hot and cold at the same time to suit the temperature at which we can drink our tea.
As you just mentioned, the rice temperature for your tea, this also brings me to geopolitics, because as we now have a discussion around the multipolar world, not anymore the US being the dominating or the West dominating everything, where does India stand here? Because you are close to China. I think you got some issues with China. You are very close to Russia. You are importing lots of the oil from Russia now, which we don't buy, and then we buy it from India. Is India following those who are challenging the Western lead, or is India doing its own way, irrespective of the West, the Russians, and the Chinese?
You know, for the last 70 years, I've seen people always ask this question. But India's foreign policy is always on the basis that we'll do what's in our self-interest. So we are not in this camp or that camp. For some matters, we'll appear to be in the Russian camp. For some other matters, we'll appear to be in the US camp. Some people find that very irritating. They would like India to be like Pakistan, align themselves to the US. We'll supply you F-16s and so on and so forth. India doesn't do that. I can't speak for India. That we are at a very good inflection point. Around 1880, Asia lost supremacy to Europe. Maybe 1800 or 1850 or whenever. Look at the Japanese-Russian War, Russo-Japanese War of 1905 as a turning point. We are at such an inflection point in the world now, where the balance is coming right back to Asia. India sees itself as an Asian power. It's a pity that we have our problems with China, we have a problem with Pakistan. But India in itself has charted its course and means to be an important player at the table, on par with other people. So that's the way you'll find India's body language and foreign policy working. We've never been in anybody's camp, and I doubt if you'll ever be in anybody's camp. I mean, you take the situation in Gaza and Israel. You take Ukraine and the position of the rest of the world. From a European or UK point of view, or an American point of view, they may think India is hedging all its bets. That might be their impression. But India says Russia has a point, and so does the West have a point. If there's a difference of opinion, it doesn't mean you can march in and do what you like. But it's not that Russia is devoid of any point. They say, can you not talk to each other, because the world's problems get solved by talking to each other. So in the same way India's foreign policy is working and the way India thinks about it, we will have a seat at the table. Maybe along with China. We don't know about Russia. And we'll sit and talk with the US or Europe on far more equal terms than in the past, because the scale is tipping. That is the essence. And that's why some people find it a bit complex to understand India's position. Why do you keep such a great friendship with Russia? But talking for myself personally, I don't think Russia is without any case at all, frankly. But if you go and read any newspaper from, or any media from Europe, you think Russia is an absolute predator and they have absolutely no case. I don't happen to agree with that. But anyway, that's a personal view.
My audience, obviously, our audience of our conversation is mostly in Germany. So what would you
And I know you have lots of experience with international companies and advising international companies and with your different management roles. What would you advise Germans to do with India? You know, German companies, should they now, is it now the right time to go to India to look for partners, how to get started, how to participate in what's going on? What is the right learning or what is the right approach for German companies towards India?
You know, Germany has been an intellectual and scientific leader for a long time, and an economic leader, of course. But my suggestion or tips would be to recognize that maybe we are at the peak or we are past the peak. And if you want to continue to prosper and grow, which I think is fair, it will not be done by competition, but by collaboration. I am not aware that Germany has any very strong record in collaboration across borders. So, whereas other colonial countries have had a record of collaborating across borders, Britain with its colonies, the Netherlands with its colonies, Germany stopped having colonies after Namibia, there was nothing. And I think Germany has a mindset change, at least so it appears to me, that whereas they could be a single unitary power, and they were conscious of it, that will not work. So the big tip I would give is, get out there and try to understand the real world, especially your Mittelstand, you know. That's a great strength of Germany. I'm not talking of the Siemens and the Volkswagens and the Porsches and so on. I'm talking of, today you'll find every German company of a premium variety in India. That's because if I'm running Mercedes or Porsche, then, so wow, there are 50 million, 100 million people. That's the size of Germany or UK, where I can sell my Porsche. So that's very big for them. But I think if the Mittelstand people would get out of that closed mindset, I think they have a closed mindset. This is my opinion. We have a very vibrant Mittelstand in India. And you have a very vibrant Mittelstand in Germany. That's the join at the bellies, not at the heads. That would be the tip that I would give.
And don't be scared of bureaucracy and politicians?
No. When there is a problem in front of you, you will be scared of it. That's human. Learn how other people manage that. You know, I'm not saying don't be scared of bureaucracy. That's a bit silly. At least I feel, I could be wrong, that Germany has long ago ceased to be outgoing in terms of learning about the rest of the world. Or let's put it this way, it could be more outgoing than it has been in the last 30 years. They've had their own problems. The fall of the wall, integration of East Germany, West Germany, your own politics is not exactly easy. So I understand all that. But if you want to come out and pick cherries from the tree, then you must select the right trees. And cherries are not always available by just reaching out. You have to climb the tree to get the cherries. That's the point I'm making.
And what about attracting people from India to move to Germany? Because we always talk about attracting highly qualified migrants. Is this the right path? Or would you rather say, like many years ago, a colleague of yours, an Indian top manager, said to me, I don't want my kids to go abroad. I want them to build India. So what's your view around immigration? Do you think, should Germany try to attract more Indians? You say, no, it's unfair. Keep the talent in India to help us build our own country.
No, I don't think so. I think if Germany can attract people, it should. It used to do that with the Hochschule program, you know, which is when I went to learn German, because back in the 60s, it was an attractive option. But that was East Germany, West Germany and other things. While the language can be an apparent barrier, Indians are very good at languages. Most Indians would speak 3 or 4 languages. Not perfectly. So if farmers from Punjab can go to Italy and grow grapes for the Italians, or go to Canada and grow wheat for the Canadians, Indians can come to Germany. But whether Germany wants them, and what kind of people do Germany want? If you want the brain power, which I think is the question you're driving at, then a very active program of attracting Indian students to come to Germany would certainly be very welcome. Today, anybody wants to send his children to America or England? It used to be England, but England has come down. It's the US now. I still think Germany has a good educational system. And especially in skill development, Germany is very good at skill development, which India sorely lacks. Again, it comes back to the Mittelstand and not the top companies or the small companies.
To finish up, India's future bright, huge opportunities, and the risk of things going wrong are low? Or would you say, well, okay, you said, you know, Mr. Moya doesn't listen to you, but let's assume he might be open and you go to Mr. Modi and say, okay, this is my advice to you in order to make sure that in 20 years, 30 years, India really has fulfilled the high hopes we Indians have, but also the world has into India. What should be done?
I think if Jack Welch had called me, which he didn't, in 1990 and said, have you any suggestions for me? And if I had the guts and the courage, I would have said, Mr. Welch, you're becoming larger than yourself. The problem is not with India. The problem is with one person. I'm not saying it is a problem, the potential problem. Otherwise, India's on a very good wicket. Who knows, I could be wrong. But too much power for too long, the world has shown. I don't have to mention names. You yourself come from a country where you have seen that happen, though perhaps 70, 80 years ago. The kind of adulation and the kind of dependence on one person, it's almost like a corporate honcho, you know? And you know what happened to Thomas Middlehoff in your own country. Very, very successful, hugely competent, well-reputed. And then when he became full of himself, things went wrong. We don't want a Thomas Middlehoff happening here. And I say this with respect. I don't know Mr. Middlehoff, and I know that he went to jail and he became very religious, but that's not the subject of our discussion. I think I wrote a book called Crash, where I trace how 15 leaders in the world were victims of themselves. And that's the only thing that worries me. And I hope some self-correction will happen.
I hope as well, Mr. Gopalakrishnan, thank you very much for your thoughts. It was a very interesting conversation. Thank you for your time. It was a very interesting conversation, and I wish you all the best. And of course, I wish you all the best towards India, that it continues to prosper and to go to basically abolish poverty and to go into a bright future. Thank you very much.
Sehr gut, vielen Dank, auf Wiedersehen.